Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report Dr. Joseph Farrell for his quarterly interview. We're going to be talking about his new and very wonderful book, Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. And so I want to welcome him, but also, Joseph, I want to ask you about your impressions of the Secret Space Program conference. We were there together, and it was quite an intense time.
Oh, yes, it certainly was. Thanks for having me back. Well, my impressions overall were I think we managed to create a critical mass to achieve some of our goal, which I think most of us had going into this conference, and that was to take the steps to remake the conference culture on these sorts of topics. I've spoken at other conferences before, and my impressions were of those conferences, other than maybe one or two speakers at them, most of them were just basically storytelling sessions, kind of evangelistic revival tent meeting sort of atmosphere, which we deliberately tried to avoid in this conference with getting some of the speakers lined up. So all in all, I think it was a very intense time. I think we created a critical mass, addressed some issues that Yaron outlined the speaker schedule in such a way that we were all playing off of each other very, very well, I thought, in spite of the fact that none of us had coordinated what we were going to say with the other speakers. We all kind of arrived blind as to what everyone else was going to do. And I think the way that he put Michael Schratt and Mark McCandlish right up front talking about some of the technologies, raising the issue of the cost of these things, then I came after them, started talking about what I think is a huge hidden system of finance. Then your presentation on Sunday morning, where you went into the two systems that were being built up on the one hand and the other one slowly torn down, moving liabilities into the old system and moving all of the assets into the new one. I thought that was, to me, that was one of the most profound observations that was made at the conference. I'm still mulling that one over.
Well, you know, that's the heart of the slow burn.
Right.
And one of my frustrations is when I try and talk to any of the financial people about why I think the slow burn, you know, what it is that has made the slow burn or what has managed to engineer it. Right. You know, they keep saying, I won't go there. Well, I won't go. Well, if you won't look at the reality that's doing this, how are we ever going to, you know, understand what's really going on? And to me, that was the power of the conference, was having so many people who could put the different pieces together. Right. That help you understand how the slow burn is being engineered.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, again, your insight that if you cannot look at this and factor it into your financial calculation, then you're committing a material omission and you've only got half the picture. And
right.
Therefore, your analysis is going to be tremendously skewed and faulty. And, you know, I'm with you four square on this. I've been hearing these financial analysts predicting collapse for the last 30 years.
Right.
it's kind of like the rapture predictions, you know, and they never happen. So, yeah, I think you've got to take it into consideration.
Right.
But I have to be four square in agreement with you about something else in the conference, and that is, I'm not going to mince words. I'm going to name names as you did in your earlier interview with your friend. I thought that Robert Morningstar just showed a complete lack of professionalism in his presentation, and ultimately a lack of courtesy to the conference organizers and the other speakers. That was totally unneeded, and it almost ruined the atmosphere that had been carefully built up that day.
Right.
And my other big problem was Stephen Bassett, who I understand was kind of invited as a last minute special panel participant, by the conference organizers, and I don't think they fully understood, nor did I, quite frankly, that he was going to take that panel discussion and monopolize a great deal of the time to preach an agenda, essentially a political agenda, from the pulpit. You know, notwithstanding the rather fulsome remarks he made about me, I was not impressed. In fact, I was so mad I was about ready to get up and walk off the panel because I found that totally out of place, very unprofessional to usurp a conference like that to preach an agenda, which many of us, I suspect, probably have some misgivings about to begin with.
Well, I'm always very concerned when people get mad and angry about something that they don't know what it is.
Right.
In other words, I can't say that something's wrong.
Right.
If I don't understand the fundamental facts of what it is. And that's part of my frustration with all that kind of,
yes,
let's get up and, you know, get really mad and do something about it. It's like, well
yes, precisely.
What is it?
And, yeah, he doesn't get the, I don't think he's ever wrestled with, you know, I'm not that familiar with his work. But my impression was he hasn't really wrestled with the technological aspects of this, with the fact that he's dealing with an ensconced group of power within the intelligence and national security community, and that group has massive tentacles and connections to the international financial community. So, you know, it was totally inappropriate to the conference. But I think Sunday we managed to put the conference back on track. So, you know, all in all, I think it was a very good experience.
Right. Well, something happened to me. I left San Francisco right after the conference and went down to Los Angeles and was there for a couple days. And I was driving over to do Coast to Coast on Monday evening.
Mm-hmm.
And one dear friend of mine was driving me over. And suddenly, driving down the highway, I could see all the different worlds. I could see the overt economy and world right in front of me. And I could see the covert and how that all worked and the flows between them. And then I could see the breakaway civilization with the underground facilities and the UFOs flying overhead. And I could all see how the three economies and financial systems weave in together.
Right.
And it's so stupefying to see it, because what's amazing to me is that you have, you know, people in different parts of the economy that don't even see the other parts, you know, when it's sitting there right in front of their face.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was a good thing that came out of this conference. I think that at least as far as the people I was talking to, you know, after sessions, it really made an impact on them, particularly the financial aspect. I think a lot of people went away from it with new lenses to interpret what's going
right
on. And in that respect, I think it was a huge success.
Right. Right. Well, you really got across in your first presentation, you're the only guy who gave two, that in your first presentation, you really got across the point about what it does to a governance system.
Right.
When you put the intelligence agencies in the position of being bankers with an entirely hidden system. You completely power shift the entire governance system of the planet when you do that.
Yes.
And then,
exactly,
you know, then you give them advanced technology and, oh boy, here we go.
Here we
yeah
go. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, I said in my review, I posted a review of your book today on the blog because I want everybody to read it ahead of when they listen to this interview. And I said, you know, as soon as you start to try and figure out what's really going on, mm-hmm, you start going back in history because, you know, obviously the official story and the real story are different. And in the process of trying to figure out the real story, you keep going back and say, well, maybe if I go back, I can figure out sort of where this all came from. You start digging back and back, and what you discover is, you know, what they taught you in university is not really what happened. And you go back and, right, you and sort of the mysteries compound. And that's why whenever I can, and it's complicated. It's, you know, as you said, when you try to drill down and figure out the Middle Ages, it can get very complicated or very boring.
Right,
it's hard. It's you know, there's almost a Middle Ages version of the begats in the Bible, you know, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat. And it's funny because I just tried to read Parsifal and sort of gave up two-thirds of the way through. I couldn't take the floral language anyway, but so it's not easy to unpack these things. And so whenever I find a scholar who's willing to dive in and try and do it, I'm deeply appreciative. And because I know it's quite an intellectual feat. But what you do is you really take us back. Let's start with the Fourth Crusade.
Okay.
Or let's, you know, something, let's start with why you decided to write this book, and then let's dive back in and start at the Fourth Crusade and move into the sort of targeting of the Cathars and the Templars and why it's so important to what's going on today.
Well, the reason I wrote the book is you've already hinted at it. I used to teach medieval history in college back when I was teaching. And if you study the Middle Ages in college at a graduate level, what you're given is a list of data. And the academic approach basically is designed, at least in my experience, to grind down the habit of inquiry, of connecting dots, and then being willing to speculate on what the implications of the connected dots mean. So in other words, what they do is basically they ground down any attempt to look at certain events as being orchestrated, coordinated, to ground down any attempt to figure out the relevance of events as coordinated events. And God help you if you look for hidden hands, if you look for hidden stories, because of course this borders on the academic taboo, which is conspiracy theory. But I think if you look at the Middle Ages, you're full of conspiracies, and big ones that span not only decades, but in some cases centuries. So that's why I wrote the book. It's the book I wanted to write back when I was a college professor, and to their credit, many of my students at that time were asking these sorts of questions, and you know, I couldn't really go into these sorts of problems in the class. And let's take the Fourth Crusade as one example. The story that you learn, and I basically outline the story in Financial Vipers of Venice, the story that you learn is that the Fourth Crusade was called by Innocent III, Lotario de Conti, and the response of Europe was to raise a crusading army. These crusaders then appointed a kind of a committee of knights to go to Venice and negotiate with the Doge. At the time it was Enrico Dandolo, the celebrated so-called blind Doge of Venice, to provide the ships, the transport, and the supplies for this crusade to go to Palestine and, you know, crack some Muslim heads together, okay? And the story is that Dandolo very cleverly diverted the crusade first to sack Zara, which is on the coast of Dalmatia, and restore it to Venetian jurisdiction. And then Dandolo successfully and very cleverly orchestrated the crusade to go to Constantinople, where eventually the Venetian army sacked it, installed a Latin emperor and a Venetian governor, and that's the story. Now, the problem with the story is if you start digging, you're going to see that you're dealing with kind of a medieval Warren report. Because, first of all, you have to look at the knights that go to Venice. Knights are already a clue that you're dealing with something very big, because a knight at the time represents a military technology and a vast expenditure. And if you look at the size of the crusading army that the knights are negotiating with Venice to be transported, the army is enormous for the period. It's some, I think, 4,000 knights, approximately 20,000 foot soldiers, plus the squires for the knights. So you're dealing with a large field army that's going to require a very large fleet. And on top of this, Venice responds, Enrico Dandolo responds to these knights, that this is going to cost approximately 94,000 marks, which is an enormous sum of money for the age. So in other words, this is your clue that you're not dealing with an ad hoc committee you're dealing with a very large organization that can field such an army. This would have been beyond the ability of any of the nation states at the time to field. So this leaves the military orders. And by the military orders, I mean, of course, the Knights Hospitallers and the Knights Templars. These are, and it's very important for people to understand right off the bat what these are. These are international armaments conglomerates that are directly under the jurisdiction of the papacy and hence exempt from any local, secular, or ecclesiastical jurisdiction. So in other words, to put it in modern terms, they're granted a tax-free exemption status. They are created as international cartels that specialize and contract for military armaments of all sorts. And on top of this, to make all of this work, by the nature of the case, they have to be specialists in international finance. So in other words, they have to have very sophisticated accounting techniques to move funds from Western Europe to the Middle East and vice versa. So all of the implications are that Venice and the Templars begin what becomes to be a traditional alliance in European geopolitics of the period. So in other words, if you're living in the 13th century, if someone says to you, oh, the Templars are doing this, then the other thing that you're going to take as a given is that Venice is going to be involved. The same right. thing with Genoa and the Knights Hospitallers. If you say one, you're going to think immediately of the other. So in other words, it's just like the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain today. This is how you would have been thinking back at that time period. Now, the problem, Catherine, is that there has never
Can I just stop you for a second? Because there are a couple things I want to bring out here. Mm-hmm. When you talk about a Templar, you're talking about somebody who in their own personhood is both a monk, right. a banker, right. and a warrior, all yes. three in one.
Exactly.
And they are running an international cartel
right.
that is above the law
right.
and is free from taxes.
Right.
That's an unbelievably powerful combination. Now, when you combine them with Venice, you're talking about the accounting tools, but you're also talking about having access to major fleets and insurance. So
right. exactly.
the Templars and Venice combined for that period are by far and away the most powerful force on the planet at that time.
They really are. And something else that people have to understand, they, as you say, they're not subject to local law. They are subject to the papacy, but this is a
right.
part of the story. And the other part of the story that people have to latch on to here is, again, what you've suggested, is that Venice is usually publicly credited with inventing double entry accounting and so on. But given the fact that they have this alliance or association with the Templars, what this means, in my opinion, and I strongly suspect, is that the accounting methods are developed by these military crusading orders, the Hospitallers, the Templars, the Teutonic Knights, and so on, and that once the Templars are disbanded, the accounting methods are probably tweaked and then made public or disclosed by the Venetians. Now, there's another part of the story that's very important for people to understand. When King Philippe le Bel, Philip IV of France, finally moves against the Templars directly in 1307, within 3 years, Venice creates the Council of Ten. The Council of Ten, for people that do not know, is kind of Venice's version of a star chamber, a legislative body that can basically rule by decree in the name of the Venetian Congress, which was their grand council. It did so directly under the Doge. On top of this, it was also responsible for coordinating all of Venice's far-flung intelligence activities, and it was also their counterintelligence organization. So what I strongly suspect Venice did is recognizing that it was going to lose its intelligence arm in the Templars should they be successfully disbanded. It created this agency as a substitute for it and probably, and again in my opinion, as a home for Templar knights, to seek refuge and basically continue their operations. So this is all what's going on. Now let's get back to the Fourth Crusade. If you study academic history, there's no real solid evidence. And they will tell you that there's no evidence that the Templars were involved in the Fourth Crusade. Now, this is patent nonsense because, as I pointed out in the book, at the end of the Fourth Crusade, a Venetian governor by the name of Marin Zeno is installed in the Byzantine Empire. He, in turn, along with the Latin emperor, send letters to Pope Innocent III stating that the crusade was over, they had sacked Constantinople, they've installed a puppet Latin governor and a Venetian governor to oversee all this, and the letter is carried to Pope Innocent by a Templar. Okay. So in other words, there were definitely Templars along with the crusade. Now this raises the question then of why were the Templars involved, and here's where it gets speculative. If you look at the history of the Templars, the official story of their founding is that 9 French knights originally went to Palestine and sought a charter from King Baudouin, and the king granted them this charter for the protection of pilgrims to the Holy Land. That's the cover story, okay, because obviously 9 knights is totally insufficient for the purpose of protecting anybody, anything. What they started doing was they started excavating
digging
almost immediately under the Temple Mount, and they did this for 9 years, and all the evidence points to the fact that they found something and that this was their real hidden purpose. In other words, their purpose initially at the very top of the organization was to uncover knowledge, okay?
Now, or technology.
Or technology or both, yeah. Exactly.
Or both, right.
And if you bear this purpose in mind and look at the Fourth Crusade with those lenses, I think you could argue a case that the Fourth Crusade was planned initially by those original French knights, who in my opinion probably were Templars, given the size of the army and the financial expenditure involved. There's no other conclusion that's reasonable. If you look at it that way, then what the Crusade was really about was they had planned deliberately to orchestrate a diversion of the Crusade precisely to get to Constantinople and sack it and gain access to whatever
in the library
was right. Precisely in the imperial archives. And it's interesting, again, if you look at it from the long-term point of view, you find all of the indicators of a hidden cartographic tradition coming after the Fourth Crusade. You've got the Piri Reis map, the Turkish admiral, showing clearly the New World. So this, I think, becomes the interest for our purposes, because...
Well, and there's something else you pointed out, which was, I think you pointed it out, or I was doing some more research on the Fourth Crusade as I was reading. They suddenly, you know, call an end to the Crusades and sail home.
Right.
And what you realize is, oh, I guess they got what they were looking for.
Exactly.
Which raises the question. And it almost feels like some of the battles, the wars we see in the Middle East today. They announce this ridiculous story of what they're up to. They go and do something else, like sacking the libraries and the museums in Iraq.
Exactly.
And then, oh, suddenly, you know, there's a different story, and you're like, what just happened?
Exactly. And I'm so
right.
Glad you raised that, because this has been one of my major points that I've been making in several books, that the Baghdad Museum looting is a part of this pattern.
Right.
And that's why the historical perspective here is so important. Now, for the financial aspects of this, we have to look at something very, very closely, and that's this hidden cartographic tradition. Because as I outline in the book, there is every evidence that the Templars had some sort of contact with the New World. There is a massive amount of bullion that is being moved into Europe secretly. And we have to recall in this connection as well that Venice is the premier European bullion trading capital at this time.
Right.
So in other words, what we have, Catherine, as a result of this hidden cartographic tradition, is we have a hidden system of finance. And
right.
It's being run by an international armaments conglomerate called the Templars. And their public front, their public bankers in all of this, are the Venetians.
Right.
And as I point out in the book, there's also a great deal of evidence, very solid evidence, that Venice itself directly undertook voyages to the New World. And I think probably as a result of intelligence activities on the part of the Council of Ten. So what we're looking at, the bottom line, is we're looking at a huge international structure. It exists outside of the normal bureaucratic channels of the various countries in which it is doing business. It exists directly under the papacy. It's got a profound and deep connection to one of the major international banking and bullion centers at the period. So we're looking at a hidden system of finance. We're looking
right, and it's growing progressively wealthier.
Exactly. And this this becomes the groundwork for a big, huge political contest that emerges subsequently in Europe. So this, this is what we're looking at. This whole idea of a breakaway group that is using crusading activity as a disguise for other things.
So,
at one point, go ahead.
Yeah, just let me summarize. So we come to the end of the Fourth Crusade, and and here's what, I'm speculating. Here's what the Templars are guarding or owning. They've brought back, and I would suggest that from earlier times, they brought back the mind control technology from the Middle East, which was part of their power and ultimately a big part, I think, of the Freemasons' power. So they come back with this mind control technology.
Mm-hmm.
They, then we get into the question of what was the Grail. We still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the question was it technology they found in the excavation or, and in addition, they come back with knowledge, including what they dig out from the archives at Constantinople,
right,
including maps of the world. So you're talking about intellectual capital of great, great value and possibly, well, certainly mind control technology, but possibly other kinds of technology with which you could literally rule the world.
Yes. Well, this is the other thing. Let's address the mind control aspects and then move into some of the esoteric things that you've brought up. In Babylon's Banksters, I pointed out that many of the ancient temples were built very deliberately. If you look at them with a purely radio engineer's eye. And this is going to sound, again, so totally off the wall and so utterly fantastic to most of your listeners, but nonetheless, this is the case. These ancient temples were built as radio-resonant cavities, and in some cases, they were even built, it appears deliberately, as being resonant to certain brainwaves that humans have, particularly the theta brainwave. So in other words, these were built as very simple radio telegraphy transmitters and receivers, believe it or not. And all it would take would be a sensitive membrane to register these things. And if you look at classical texts, part of the mystery is you'll find Roman authors stating, well, they sent to the emperor, far-flung armies of the Roman Empire, they sent to the emperor and heard back a day later. Now, not even with fire signals and semaphore devices would this have been very efficient or possible. So there's some sort of technology involved. And it's interesting, when you look at the Templars, they begin another curious activity. And to put it in modern terms, I'm going to draw an analogy. The Templars begin starting up builders' guilds, and they're connected with some of the great Gothic cathedral building in Europe
right,
that just erupts after the first crusading activities that they're involved with. This would be rather similar to the Pentagon showing up in your hometown saying that they want to build you a big church. This is exactly what's going on. So the question becomes, why are they doing this? And when you look at some of these churches, Chartres Cathedral being a prime example, when you look at them, you find a very stunning omission of certain basic symbols of Christian orthodoxy, like the crucifixion. There are all these little indicators that there's something else afoot here. Now, let's go to the esoteric aspect.
You know, the cathedrals were the big draw to build the markets.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So you have an economic purpose, but there's an esoteric one, and this brings up this whole question of the Grail. Because in the book, I point out something that most people don't get, including many academics. I've read all sorts of academic studies before doing this book. And one in particular said, well, there's absolutely no connection between the Templars and the Languedoc in southern France. This is the region of southern France, right along the Pyrenees Mountains, that was the center of the Albigensians, the Cathars, all right? Now, it just so happens that most of the Templars' holdings in Western Europe were concentrated in the Languedoc. And part of the reason is that the Templars were also heavily involved in the crusading activity in Spain to drive out the Moors. So they needed supply lines and so on and so forth. But what this also means is that they're going to be in regular day-to-day operational contact with the Cathar nobility. All right? So let's go to the Albigensian Crusade, which is, you know, along with the Holocaust, this is one of the most brutal, murderous, evil, genocidal chapters in Western history, because the papacy had determined that it was going to extirpate heresy, all right? So Alexander, Pope Alexander, calls for a crusade, and he suddenly dies, and this call is picked up once again by Innocent III, Lotario de Conti. And you have to understand now the significance of what I'm going to say. Because the crusade is organized by the Cistercian order. It's headed by the Grand Prior of the Cistercians at the time, Arnaud de Citeaux. And you have to recall that when the Templars were founded, they were in bed tight with Bernard of Clairvaux and the Cistercian order. But during the Albigensian Crusade, the Templars, along with the Hospitallers, are completely absent from the crusade. So in other words, these two orders, particularly the Templars, which were supposedly directly under papal obedience, defy the papacy. They don't participate in this crusade, which basically slaughters the Cathars. And when you study the history, there's a German fellow by the name of Otto Rahn that I talk about in the book that goes to the Languedoc in early 1930s. He travels around asking the local French people there, you know, what their lore concerning the crusade was. And he runs into a French shepherd who tells him that what the crusading armies were really looking for was the Grail, which turns out to be, and I know this is going to be a whopper, turns out to be the stones from Lucifer's crown, which, according to the shepherds, they wanted to place on the papal tiara, okay? So in other words, the local lore is that the crusade was a cover to accomplish other objectives, one of which was to reacquire some lost technology of some sort. And the other part of this is, if you stop and think about what's really going on here, is that Innocent III was extremely distressed about the fact that the Fourth Crusade had sacked Constantinople. Then he calls a crusade against the...
Which was a Christian
civilization.
And they weren't running around killing the Muslims, they were killing Christians.
They were killing Christians, right.
Right.
So at this juncture, you have to ask yourself, and this is the approach I take in the book, this is the dot connecting that I take. At this point, the papacy knows that something is up and something is basically out of its control. In a factual sense, even though in a juridical sense, the Templars are nominally under the papacy. So if you look at what the Albigensian Crusade really is, it's a blow that is being struck against the economic center of Templar activity in Western Europe. And there's something very important here, and I hinted at this in the book. I didn't come right out and spend much time with it. The Templars were also deeded on the death of King Juan II of Aragon, were deeded his entire kingdom.
So wow.
They were attempting to set up their own state in Western Europe.
See, I didn't know that because I know they'd considered doing it in Cyprus, and I always thought it was a mistake not to create their own sovereign area. But I didn't know that about Spain.
Oh, yeah. This is what they were attempting to do. So the Albigensian Crusade, if you look at it, is a strike against the center of their power. In other words, what I'm saying is you have to look at the whole span of the Albigensian Crusade up to Philip IV's suppression of the Templars as one political operational complex. What's going on here is an internal war in Western Europe between the international order of the church versus a local, very different culture and order represented by the Cathars and in turn their connection to the Templars. So the papacy is doing this as part of a grand strategy. They are taking out the economic center and thereby the political center of Templar power in Western Europe. And then once this is removed, then you have Philip IV striking against the Templars some decades later in 1307. So this is a huge story. You're dealing ultimately with two different worldviews. You've got an international world order represented by the papacy versus a local sovereignty represented by the Cathars. And this is what the Fourth Crusade really is. The Albigensian Crusade. It's a struggle of cosmologies, of finance, and all of that.
Right. There is a different, a real difference to me in the cosmology.
Oh, yes.
And maybe we could touch a little bit about that. The Cathars were a much more, I'm not an expert at this, but they were much more, I would say, open to individual growth and potential.
Yes, they absolutely were. From the standpoint of the church's orthodoxy at that time, they were clearly in heresy as far as what the church was concerned. But what their cosmology really represents, in my opinion, even though it has some dualistic and Gnostic elements, what it really represents, as far as I'm concerned, is a public expression of what I've been calling in my books the topological metaphor. And what that metaphor is basically it's a cosmology whereby all differentiation that you observe in creation is part of a fecund process that creates, that allows creation. And therefore, in Cathar thinking, there really isn't an approved special revelation or institution, and therefore their society is extremely tolerant. They were very tolerant of Roman Catholics in their midst. It was kind of the earliest manifestation of what will later become kind of the secularized Protestant cultures that emerged after the Reformation. So they were very, very tolerant. And as a consequence of that, the Languedoc in southern France at that time period was very, very prosperous relative to the other European states and countries around it. It was very prosperous. And of course, from the point of view of the papacy, this could have spread the heresy far and wide if it had been allowed to continue. So I think, again, you have economic and political motivations for this crusade, not to mention the hidden ones of trying to reacquire some sort of hidden technology of some sort. This is the real reason for that particular grisly episode in European history.
You know, one of the things I've never thought about, but it's interesting to think about, is that the history of the development of capital and the accumulation of sort of intergenerational pools of capital is where groups, you know, there are two kinds of technology that really drive that. One is, of course, arms and military, but the other is communication. And so where I can arbitrage values wherever I can communicate faster than you can. So if I control the Western Union or I control the telephones and I can talk to people around the world and right. arbitrage the difference in values, you know, for bullion banking, you point out the Venetians trading the gold-silver ratio. I can build vast fortunes if I can communicate just a little bit faster.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's interesting to wonder what the Grail technology was.
Well, this is why I began this whole series with Babylon's banksters and pointing out that with some of the ancient temples, and I think also in possible reality, that you have to look at some of the Gothic cathedrals precisely in this way. They're big, huge, simple radio cavity resonators. They're, you know, that would have been possibly used for some sort of simple telegraphy from one point to the other. After
right.
all, you're not going to be able, if you're the Templars or Hospitallers, to coordinate this international banking activity that they have going without some form of hidden communication systems that enables it. So I think you're dead on there. I think this is something that has to be looked at as a possibility. Otherwise, the system simply isn't going to work. And when we get to Philippe Lebel in France, I think it's very clear from the record, and I try to put as many of these records in the book as I can, I think it's fairly clear that he, far from being the man that's controlling the papacy at the time, it's the other way around. The papacy is controlling him. And again, let me point this out. In academic studies, what they will tell you is that Philippe Lebel's motivations for trying to suppress the Templars was that he needed money and they had, you know, they were the goose with the golden eggs. And they had refused him a loan that he had requested, so he struck at them. That's the academic explanation. But when you examine what actually happens once the Templars are formally suppressed, the Council of Vienne in France does not allow Philip IV to recover anything. All of that Templar loot is supposedly moved into the Knights Hospitallers. So, you know, the loot just goes to another international armaments conglomerate. And many of the Templars themselves in certain regions of Europe that don't follow his lead and try to suppress them, many of the Templars themselves just disappear into other military orders, like the Teutonic Knights, the Knights Hospitallers, and I strongly suspect into the Venetian Council of Ten, because long after you have the suppression of the Templars, you have Venice writing of members of that council as being knights. So in other words, that's another clue that you're dealing with an organization that perhaps just went underground after the formal suppression.
Well, that's the question. Did they merge back into the metastructure the way the Nazis did, or did they somehow maintain a separate continuing
organization?
And it was funny because when I was reading that part in the book, I got this chill down my spine and I thought, you know, I thought the Underground Railroads were built after World War II with black budget money, but what if this has been going on for centuries?
I think that's exactly what happened, Catherine. I think that there are enough indicators in the literature, if you're willing to look for them, to indicate that a bit of both occurred. Some sort of organization persists after the official demise of the Templars. And the reason I can say that with relative confidence is in the book I go as far as the beginning of the early Enlightenment. And when you look at certain events that just barely predate the beginning of the 30 Years' War, one of the most significant is that the Prince of the Rhineland Palatinate, a fellow by the name of Friedrich von Wittelsbach, and there's a name for people following the bloodline story. Friedrich von Wittelsbach is married by an arranged political marriage with the daughter of King James Stuart I of England. So Princess Elizabeth and Friedrich, you know, are married. They go back from England back to the Rhineland Palatinate, and he is elected King of Bohemia by the Protestant clergy there. The Catholic Habsburgs, of course, will have nothing to do with this, so they march. They defeat Friedrich's forces at the Battle of White Mountain in 1621, end of story. That's the academic presentation. But dig deeper and you find out that Prince Friedrich von Wittelsbach is related, family ties, to the de Bouillon family in France. And who are the de Bouillons? Well, Godefroy de Bouillon was one of the original nine founding knights of the Knights Templar. And furthermore, at the time of the all of this going on in Bohemia in the 1620s, you also have the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos. And what is the symbol of the Rosicrucians? Well, it's a red cross on a white background. And whose emblem is that?
You know? Right.
So I think something of the organization did persist, and I also think that some individual Templars, depending upon their local circumstances, end up in other orders in Spain and Portugal and the Venetian Council of Ten, the Teutonic Knights. So it blends into the post-suppression metastructure, but there's some sort of organization that is also continuing that's coordinating all of this. So I have to answer both and rather than either or.
Right. One of the things I've always had trouble communicating to our subscribers and people who ask is, you know, the people responsible for managing intergenerational capital are extremely risk adverse.
Right.
And if you look at history, you will understand why they are extremely risk adverse. If you look at what happened to the Cathars, if you look at what happened to the Templars, you know, here you have groups that are very, very successful and getting more so. And what happens? You know, it throws the balance of power, you know, awry, and suddenly you get these unbelievable attacks. So if you've ever read the story of what happened to the Cathars or the Templars, you can imagine why passed down through the generations would be people who, you know, who, as I was taught my whole life until, you know, I started to speak publicly, I thought conspiracies was just the way things were organized. I thought how we organized everything. I didn't know there was anything wrong with it. It just is how you got something done.
Well, let's look at that for a moment, because let's look at the Templars once again from another point of view. They're not only an international armaments complex that's going around that region of the world trying to pick up any sort of secret knowledge that it can, but what else is it? It is precisely an organization that by dint of existing outside of the feudal system at that time is precisely a system that can minimize risk, because after all, they're having to transfer huge amounts of money for the period from Western Europe to the Middle East and back, and vice versa. So this is one thing. It represents the first creation of an organization that will allow you to accumulate intergenerational capital. And by the same token, their allies, Venice, had acquired very early on charters both from the Holy Roman emperors and from the Byzantine emperors that allowed them to exist in a kind of an autonomous state outside of the feudal system.
And okay, so I have to stop you here, because I think there are very few people who have had an education in what it meant to our lives, our lifestyle. You know, to me, the invention of financial liquidity through time and space was like the second invention of fire. You know, it's like discovering fire for the second time. And if you look at this planet, whether it's the energy model or financial liquidity has made extraordinary things possible without which, you know, we couldn't. And it's quite remarkable that you and I can go down, open an account at a financial institution and be pretty confident that the money's going to be there, you know, either if we die, our heirs are going to be able to claim. In other words, there's a thing going on, and I've lived in worlds where it's not going on and you can't get it, and that's pretty frightening. That's the, you know, that's a pretty Orwellian world. So financial liquidity is an extraordinary thing, and I think it's not something that our normal education helps us understand the power of it and the importance.
No, they don't. They don't. And since you're on that subject, let's put the same point a bit differently. Without the Templars, you would not have had the ability to minimize risk in international finance. They're the ones minimizing it. And the other thing that would not have been possible in Western European history is precisely the accumulation of capital. So in other words, you cannot understand the emergence of what we would consider modern financial methods and techniques and institutions in the Renaissance without them. It's simply
Here's what I didn't understand until I met you and started to read your work. To me, the power is when you combine Venice with the Templars, because it was Venice that really drove the insurance business.
Right.
So, or the early insurance business. So the combination of Venice with insurance and one or both of them with accounting, with the Templars being able, because, you know, without enforcement, there is no financial system, let alone liquidity. Right. So by being able to, you know, shake a hand in Venice and then show up in Spain and pick up your gold.
Right, exactly.
And it's the combination of Venice and the Templars that make that.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You cannot understand European politics, finance, or history without understanding this period. And the other thing we need to remember is the financial elites certainly know this history. They know the techniques that were used. They have mimicked them time and again throughout history. They've created international structures that, if you look at them, are very medieval, if you compare them to what's going on during this time period of history. So you really need this information from just the financial history point of view in order to understand what's going on today. Because
right. If you look, you know, it's funny, if you look at the BRICS now setting up their own development bank,
right.
The question is, this is all about channels and everybody having to put their money through the official channel.
Right.
So what we're saying is that the Templars and Venice in combination had created, you know, pathways of liquidity outside the papacy and the church that were more powerful. And the church's power, you know, couldn't let that happen. They needed the financial channels to go through them.
Right.
So
exactly.
Right, and it's the same issue we're watching now. So you see the United States, you know, demanding all sorts of subjugation from the Swiss banks because they can't afford the leakage. They need everything to go through their channel.
Exactly.
And so it's all about the financial channels and the war between, you know, the war between clearance and settlement systems.
Yes, exactly. And this you've raised another important point that's very important for people to understand, and that's the creation of the Inquisition. Most people don't realize that the Inquisition was created as an institution during the Albigensian Cathar Crusade. And when you look at the charter of the Inquisition, it had the ability to confiscate the financial and real property holdings of people that it accused. So in other words, what the Inquisition is it is as much a counterintelligence and financial counterintelligence mm-hmm. institution that's set up as a competitor to these international crusading orders.
You know what we call it?
What?
The control and concentration of cash flow.
Yep, exactly.
The Inquisition was about the control and concentration of cash flow.
Exactly. That's exactly so. And again, it's important for people to understand these models are there in the historical record if you're willing to take the academic lenses off and start connecting dots and thinking about the deep political and financial implications of what's really going on.
Well, the more Go ahead.
Well, this is why I stress the fact in the book that when you look at the founding of the Templars and the cover story and the fact that what they're really after is hidden knowledge, when you look at the Fourth Crusade, when you look at the Albigensian Crusade, when you look at the subsequent suppression of the Templars by Philip IV, and then look at the politics of the early Protestant princes just prior to the 30 Years' War, what you're looking at is one big, huge operational complex that is really struggling to see who's going to end up on top of this political financial complex that's being built
right.
during the Middle Ages. That's what you're looking at.
Right. On that, there were so many times in the book when I just felt like I was reading the story of sort of the United States invasion of Iraq. You know, if you, I just went back and there's a new documentary on Cheney that I watched recently. And if you look at all of his efforts to get us into the war, you know, you think, well, maybe the Germans did find, you know, a grail technology in their excavation over there. Uh-huh. And it suddenly, you know, that's the only explanation I've ever come up with that explains Cheney's behavior. In other words, and then the looting of the museum, but you get this feeling of, you know, there's a cover story and then there's a real story and we don't know what the real story is, but the cover story makes no sense. But meantime, these people are not crazy. You know, whatever Dick Cheney is, he's not the nut that everybody says he is.
No.
He had a reason. He had a real politic reason to do what he did, and we just don't know what it is yet.
Well, let's talk about the Baghdad Museum looting for a moment. I've talked about it in various books of mine, usually by way of footnote, but I think, again, we have to go back and look at the story. The story was that people were seen in American uniforms entering and leaving the museum and carting stuff out. Now, prior to the American and British intervention and invasion, the government of Saddam Hussein had many archaeological teams all over Iraq digging for him. Most of those teams were French and German. And most of those catalogs, the field catalogs of what they were actually finding, so far as I've been able to determine, were kept by the French and the Germans and not made privy to the British or Americans. And the story that the American colonel, Marine Colonel Bogdanovich, recovered most of the art objects is true. But what they're not telling you is that the cuneiform tablets that were also looted, those in most cases are still missing. And you have to dig long and hard even to find any news about them. And this is the problem. The other part of the problem is that Der Spiegel in Germany was the first major Western press that broke the story of the Baghdad Museum looting. So I do think you're correct. I think there's something going on there. I don't necessarily think we were involved with the looting. It could very easily have been the German BND, which has a heavy and still does have a heavy human on-the-ground presence in Iraq. It might have been them, you know, pulling a classic false flag operation. I don't know. But clearly, I think you're right. I think there's something else.
Somebody, going on. You know, there may have been a weapon of mass destruction, but it wasn't nuclear.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I go back.
It could have been more powerful than nuclear.
Well, I go back to my book, The Cosmic War. If you read that book, I point out that the Mesopotamian texts are constantly talking about the so-called tablets of destinies, or Megalgal in Akkadian. And what these things are, if you read the text, is they contain, and I'm quoting here, all the power of the universe. So whatever these things are, you know, if you're of that kind of Templar mindset of, you know, we're going to go in there with a military expedition, but what we're really looking for are texts and technologies. Well, look at what's happening in the Middle East now. You have the Iraq invasion. In Egypt, you have, prior to the fall of Mubarak, you had the Egyptian government all of a sudden building a wall around the Giza compound and not explaining exactly why. The public story was, well, we're going to protect the compound from terrorists. Well, I'm sorry. A suicide bomber with a strap-on bomb isn't going to be able to do any significant damage to those structures. So I think there was something else going on, and it had to do with antiquities. And sure enough, during all the upheaval in Egypt, there were these stories that popped up every now and then that antiquities were being looted. And they even went so far as to include Dr. Zahi Hawass, the Minister of Antiquities at the time, in some of that activity. And again, with Libya, you've got all sorts of ancient sites in southeastern Libya that only became known during the same time period. So I think, yeah, there's a possibility that we're dealing with a hidden agenda here that has to do with some of these antiquities and ancient.
Scarf up the knowledge and make sure no one else can get it.
Scarf up the knowledge and make sure no one else can get it. Because, again, you know, Egyptian texts are full of allusions to this stuff. Ugaritic texts are, Mesopotamian texts are, and it's the scene of all of this upheaval today.
One of the things, the last things I wanted to bring up, because it's one thing that I've always believed is very important, but I've never been able to really unpack what it's all about, and that is the bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions I've always had is the reason that, you know, the group flowing out of this time, you know, my experiences with the Masons, is the reason they're so obsessed with bloodlines and engage in breeding programs because of a connection or relationship between the DNA and the use of some of these technologies.
Oh boy. Ding, ding, ding. I don't know if you've read my book, The Cosmic War, but I talk about...
Of course.
Okay. Well, I talk precisely about this point in that book. If you look at these so-called tablets of destinies, wars are being fought over their possession, and wars are being fought with them. So they represent, at least in the mythological text, some sort of technology. But the curious thing is that they only seem to be activated either in close physical proximity or actual physical contact with whoever is using them. And I speculate precisely on this point. Perhaps you're dealing with some sort of biometric technology that can only be used by certain people with the requisite genetic signature. So is that a possibility? Again, I think so, if you read the texts closely with that sort of viewpoint, with that sort of set of lenses on. And bloodlines, my goodness, you know, I don't think anyone can come away from this book without the distinct impression that they keep popping up against all of the same families or family connections over and over and over and over again. You know, one is a coincidence, two is a synchronicity, and three is...
No, I can just tell you from personal experience, bloodlines is of the utmost significance.
Oh yeah, I agree.
The human race doesn't just happen, it gets bred.
Yes, I again, you have no argument from me that there's another factor that's been at work here for millennia, and this is what I was also attempting to communicate in this book. You're dealing with agendas, with plots, with conspiracies, whatever you want to call it, that span centuries. And
the moral of their historical experiences, they need to go about things discreetly and quietly. It's a dangerous game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an extremely dangerous game.
Right. Well, after the suppression of the Templars and the Cathars, we move forward, and one of the things you take a portion of the book to discuss is the really literally explosion of a more enlightened cultural pattern, and the Hermetica, and you spend a fair amount of time. I love Shakespeare, so I enjoyed the discussion of Shakespeare, and I now look at the Merchant of Venice in a whole new way. But it was really funny in the book where you're talking about all the world's a stage and how they organize the stage, and they're literally showing you how people can invent their world. You know, it's all the world is a stage, and I wrote next to it, reality TV. Here we go, the first reality TV. Anyway, so, but we have this explosion of the culture popping up everywhere in a sort of seemingly spontaneous way, in a way that no formal, you know, the papacy could never come down hard on it because there's no center.
Right.
There's no formal organization. It's just bursting up all over the place.
Right.
And as you point out, this may not just be some kind of coincidence.
Well, from my point of view, Catherine, I don't think that this is entirely coincidental. One of the reasons I spent so much time in the book with people like Shakespeare, with Friedrich von Wittelsbach, with the Rosicrucians and the Merchant of Venice, was to point out that when you look at the people involved in spreading this kind of Christianized hermetic culture, what you're looking at are people who are deeply connected with each other. They're sharing views, they're buying each other's books, they're promulgating these things in literature, in art, in music, in theater, and so on. And if you look carefully at the center of this activity, guess where it is? It's Venice.
Right.
And in this respect, I point out something that I pointed out in Financial Vipers of Venice. You have Gospero Cardinal Contarini, Venetian cardinal, who's corresponding with Martin Luther, and at the same time, he's chairing for the papacy, kind of the steering committee, as it were, for the Council of Trent and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. And he's the guy that is sponsoring Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, to get papal approval. So in other words, he's playing both sides of the fence. If you look at other people in Venice, particularly someone by the name of Francesco Zorzi, this man is the internationally renowned canonist at the time. So in other words, when Henry VIII is wanting his divorce from Catherine of Aragon, the person that he's consulting with is Francesco Zorzi. If you look, however, very closely at who Zorzi is and what he's up to, he's also one of these Renaissance magicians. He's steeped in all of this hermetic literature. He's steeped in Kabbalah and so on and so forth. And these ideas are spreading from Zorzi to people like John Dee in Elizabethan England, to Robert Fludd in Jacobean England. There's this huge Venetian connection and influence with the spread of these hermetic ideas. So you have to look
at
that.
Well, did Venice throw its lot in with the city at that point and then start to finance all this stuff?
This is the big, huge question.
How did the bullion trade move from
Venice
into Amsterdam and the city?
And London. The big, huge question. And other researchers have maintained this, and what they have been doing is they've been maintaining this without the footnotes. So I'm trying to find the footnotes, but I suspect that this is the case because, and here's something I didn't put in the book, I haven't talked about it publicly yet, I'll do a little bit of it here. What the Venetian oligarchical families also had was they had their family fondi, which is the Italian name for their family fortune. If you look at what the word fondi means, it means foundation. So in other words, I strongly suspect that what they did, this is in my opinion the real beginning of the modern idea of a foundation, where you move the family, your personal fortune, into what we would call a nonprofit organization. And that organization in turn becomes the mechanism by which you continue your control of the money, you continue it outside of tax law, and it becomes the organization by which you move your money from one place to another. So you do have very significant Venetian families that begin to be present on a permanent basis within Elizabethan England. You do have some sort of connection, I'm not certain exactly what it is, between Venice and Amsterdam, but you can kind of see the influence at work just by looking at Amsterdam. What is it? It's a city built in a swamp with canals. You have it.
Well, all Amsterdam, you know, Holland and then the city, you know, they were all seafaring nations. Their success depended on their seafaring.
Right. I think it's inevitable that you have to entertain the idea that the Venetian oligarchy isn't simply going to sit and let geopolitical events and the open disclosure of the New World move events away from them. You know, there's not a financial elite in history that I know of that sat back passively and simply allowed events to overtake them. So I think, you have to entertain the possibility. But as yet, I have to be very honest and say, as yet I've not found enough evidence other than conceptual links tying these three centers together. But I think the conceptual links alone, if you really stop to look at them and look at the founding of the East India Companies in Holland and Britain and France and so on, when you look at these colonies, what you're seeing, or pardon me, these companies, what you're seeing is a Venetian model being applied on a very, very large scale. And to me, that inevitably is going to invoke some Venetian hand in Genoese.
Right.
Activity.
Without getting into it, we have to mention the history of the creation of partnerships and corporations.
Right.
And because that's part of how this... And what we're seeing globally is the emergence of the corporation as the owner and asset manager, the intergenerational institution to own and manage assets instead of
exactly.
sovereign governments.
Exactly, exactly. That's
so
exactly
it's found,
what's
it's,
going on.
And I should say it's foundations and corporations, not just corporations.
Well, the other thing that people need to recall in this regard is if you look at the period of history from, say, 1600 or so up to about the very beginning of the 19th century, what you're really looking at is a global order that is being run by corporations behind the typical sovereign governments. We tend to think of competition between France and England, but what you really have is competition between the companies that are chartered by the crowns of those particular countries. So that's really what's going on here. Without getting into details, I've started looking at the Louisiana Purchase. I've got to tell you, you want to talk about some high geopolitics and financial sculpture.
Oh, I'm sure.
That's just full of it. But, you know, the model is there. There is certainly a Venetian influence, as I said, with the politics of the age. You cannot understand Shakespeare. First of all, you can't understand Shakespeare, really, if you assume that the guy from Stratford-on-Avon is the author of all of that stuff. That just doesn't fly. But once you entertain a more aristocratic authorship for the plays, then it begins to make sense. Because
right.
you mentioned Merchant of Venice. I'm of the Earl of Oxford hypothesis for Shakespearean authorship. And it's very interesting that Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, spent time in Venice. He made it his headquarters. And he was very well acquainted, as most of the intellectual elite at that time were, with all this Hermetic literature. And once you look at what's going on in the play, it's very, very clear that this is a play that was composed by someone with a thorough knowledge of esoteric systems and particularly the Kabbalah. It's just stunning and remarkable. There's no getting around it.
You know, Shakespeare's plays really were an amazing way to teach the common man how things
yes.
really worked,
yes.
but in a way that would attract sympathy for the leadership.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
The, you know, Henry VIII is one of my favorite plays. It's usually not considered one of his best in the canon, but you look at the play and it's full of court protocol that someone from Stratford-on-Avon just wouldn't have known. There's
right.
no two ways about this. But when you
is that the one with the phrase about the good heart? The good heart is the sun and the moon. Is that the right Henry?
So. I think so. It's one of the Henrys. But again,
I'll have to go back and look.
You see a clear Hermetic influence in the plays with the fact that, you know, the good Catholic, you know, goes to heaven. The good Protestant goes to heaven. There's none of this religious partisanism, and this is a viewpoint coming directly out of that Hermetic view. It's a viewpoint that, in a certain sense, if you look at it carefully, can be traced all the way back to the Cathars that are tolerant, you know, of Catholics in their midst and so on. So all of this is exploding. And when you factor in the fact that you have the appearance during the early 1620s, circa that period, of the Rosicrucian manifestos, you're clearly dealing with a Europe that is being, to some extent, orchestrated by some sort of hidden hand to transform the cultural order. And Protestantism and Catholicism aren't the only players. There's the hidden player of Hermeticism, which I think people really have to clue into. Otherwise, they just simply are not going to understand what's going on.
Right. Well, it's the review's up on the blog. It links to your website where you can get this and the other books in the series. So Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age and Babylon Banksters and the Financial Vipers of Venice. Now, before we close, I want to go back to one of my great frustrations that results in my deep satisfaction when I read your books. And that is you cannot talk about, you know, I will get on a radio show and I'll have somebody say, oh, well, don't you think we should shut down the Federal Reserve and issue digital currency? And I go crazy because financial liquidity is so powerful and so important to the general health of everybody and everything. So you don't, right. It's like, I'm not going to open up your brain and do surgery on your brain. Just, you know, oh, what a great idea. Let's open your brain and cut. No. So this, we're talking about a living system that's very powerful and, you know, has been risk managed and evolved over the centuries, but it's all part of a governance system. In other words, a financial system is a component of a governance system, and you can't change one component unless you're willing to look at the whole thing. It's like me saying I could chop off my foot and it wouldn't have an impact on my heart. Do you know what I mean? Right. So you can't think about the governance system. The governance system sits on a cosmology, on a culture.
Yes.
So I don't want to talk about how we're going to change the currency system. I want to know what are the cosmologies and the networks, the governance networks at play, and what needs to change there. And part of my frustration, of course, is I still don't quite know what's going on. I'm just trying to figure it out. But I know that you've got to start with cosmology.
Yes, absolutely.
And so anybody who wants to talk money without talking cosmology frightens me to death.
Can't be done. It cannot be.
Yeah.
I'm in the same boat, Catherine. I've been trying to figure out what are the competing cosmologies. And I always come back to two basic and very different systems. One system of cosmology views creation, and this is coming directly out of Hermetic systems and ancient what I call pre-Yahwist religions. In other words, they're religions of nature and nature's God, as distinct from religions claiming some sort of special direct revelation. In those systems, it appears to me that what the cosmology is, it's a cosmology of the free and endless creation of information.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's a cosmology that is not based, as our Western system has been for so long, on an idea of an infinite debt owed to an infinitely angry God.
Right.
Yeah. Run by
grumpy old men.
Run by grumpy old men. Yes, wearing skirts. I think that's the first cosmology, and the financial systems that you see in place in those ancient societies are basically systems of money, where it's very difficult to ascertain whether there's an equivalent of a central bank. The answer, again, is yes and no, because usually in those societies, money or the medium of exchange is directly tied both to the crown and to the religious temple. At a certain point in ancient history, you begin the rise of the bullion banking class, and they have a very different cosmology. Their cosmology is a cosmology of a closed system and ergo of scarcity of resources that are always being depleted and competition for them. And hence, what you get out of those cosmologies is what I call the facsimile of money, which is monetized debt that functions as a medium of exchange. And that's the system that we have been living under for millennia. Now, the problem here that I think the financial elites are being confronted with today is that technologies are clearly moving to an open systems physics and therefore are implying an open systems cosmology. Just stop and think. If cold fusion, for example, or zero point energy were ever be able to be tapped by any sort of technology, and I think they already are. This is,
yeah, I don't see how they run all the underground stuff without them.
Exactly. Right. I think the technologies already exist in kind of Mark I first version models. And therefore, this is going to imply a vastly different system of finance. And what really is going on, to a certain extent, in my opinion, and I'm borrowing your phrase here, is that I think they're at a bit of a loss as to how to, so to speak, reinvent money. Because the model that they've been operating under for so long and that they're
has to change.
Yeah, it has to change. But they've operated under the old model and old system for so long that they don't really quite understand how to go about setting up the infrastructure and institutions to manage this transition. So I think we're living in that age of cosmological change. I think you're seeing the death of kind of a closed system cosmology and a new cosmology beginning to percolate, and it's going to have drastic, I can't underline this enough, it's going to have drastic effect on the financial institutions of the future. In 100 years, we're not going to recognize it.
You know, it's interesting. I just read, I was doing a study on the equity system, because if you're going to go to a world run by sovereign governments to a world run by corporations, then you've got to go from a debt model to equity.
Yes.
And corporations can do debt, but they can't issue debt infinitely the way sovereign governments can.
Right.
So you're going to – and of course, what we saw in 19 when was it? Because I was in the Bush administration when this – or after the Bush administration when I did this. The SEC put together a task force for emerging markets and was going around the world helping people create equity. And I'll never forget being in Shanghai in 97 when the equity markets were just getting going. And, you know, so equity markets around the world is a relatively new thing. And I was looking the other day, I was reading a McKinsey study that said, you know, we've got a problem because the emerging markets grow, they put their money in banks and real estate, they don't buy equities. And, you know, because equities is really a Western phenomenon, equity investment. Well, we just saw this new study, I know you picked up on it, where sovereign wealth funds and government pension funds and other government entities have now purchased $29 trillion of the $130 trillion of cross-border assets, including huge equity. So, in fact, equity ownership in one sense in the emerging markets is increasing, but it's driven by these governmental entities. Now the biggest owner of equities is the Chinese, is the Chinese wealth fund, sovereign wealth fund. So it's quite extraordinary how they're kind of evolving it, because it appears that they are moving towards more of an equity system.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's put it this way. I think that analysis is true, and what it represents for me is you cannot have, when you say equity system, equity-based system of finance and an equity-based system of media of exchange, what you're really talking about is an open systems cosmology. You can't have
right.
one without the other. And this to me is a clear signal that they do understand that they are in an age of transition where technologies are going to be driving the financial structure and institutions that are being created. So, yeah, I think and again, I think this is the relevance of all of this story of the Middle Ages and so on and so forth, because ultimately what you see in the conflict between the Templars and the Cathars on the one hand and the papacy on the other is you have the competing technologies, an equity-based open systems cosmology on the one hand, and a debt-based scarce resources type closed system cosmology on the other. I think that's exactly what's driving it.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at the nature of the assets that we're dealing with, you have both, and I'll show you how it works. Let's say you have an oil well and I have money, and I want your oil well and you want my money. So I trade you, but then I kill you and take back the oil well. So now I have the money and the oil well, and I'm better off. Crime pays. Okay? Uh-huh. But let's say I create a database and I sell you a database. If I kill you, I'm worse off. Instead, if you grow your database and you and I do a joint venture, we can create a new thing. So I'm much better off with you thriving because I can make more money from your success.
Exactly.
And so we have both, you know, we have both the land and oil and the concrete, but then we have this other thing happening. And you're seeing both economics kind of battle it out in the whole process. And between open and closed, and everybody trying to figure out how they're better off.
Right.
And here's what it's going to come down to. The reality is the system that can maintain financial liquidity will always be the wealthier, and you can't create and maintain financial liquidity without trust.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This, bingo. I can't improve on that.
And that's what the Department of Justice and the Department of Treasury are grappling with. How do they maintain their financial liquidity through force? You know, and I could never understand why so much fantastic amounts of money are spent on promoting the official story. And that's because they're trying to maintain the trust of the liquidity and the, you know, and the force at the same time. And of course it's, when, you know, it's fraying.
it's counterproductive because force, the amounts of force that they're resorting to are indicators of the fact that they're losing trust, and they're going about trying to restore that trust in all the wrong ways. This is precisely the problem. So, yeah, I'm totally in agreement with
okay.
you.
Okay. Well, to be discussed later, okay. how we create a system of trust, and what is the cosmology upon which it must be based to be strong and powerful and hold through the ages.
Right.
Clearly, as I can tell from your book, this is a century-old conversation, but it will continue here at the Solari Report.
Excellent. I'm for that.
Okay, well, Joseph, thank you again. This is a wonderful conversation. Have a great evening.
Yeah, you too, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on.
Thank you.